Best-selling author James Rollins has written more than 30 books. It's hard to imagine any have more moving parts than his latest, The Seventh Plague. It's another in his Sigma Force series. The Parkway School District and Mizzou Veterinary School grad has put the Bible and biblical plague, science, Mark Twain, Stanley and Livingston, and an Arctic Circle chase together in one book, and that gives it a very broad plot line. Toss in mummies and mummification, and it expands further. The Seventh Plague has it all, and we have James Rollins. I spoke to him a few days ago and asked for a thumbnail plot overview.
Well, the story starts when an archaeologist comes stumbling out of the Egyptian desert. He's been missing for 2 years, vanished without a trace along with a survey team. But when he comes out of that, unfortunately, he passes away. He can't tell his story. But his body offers some tantalizing clues. Number one, it appears his body is partially mummified, as if he'd gone through this gruesome process while he was still alive. Number two, he seems to be harboring a plague organism that begins to spread throughout Cairo and beyond, and Sigma Force, my team of heroes, is called in to find out where he's been all this time, where did this organism come from, is there a possible cure before that one plague cascades into a series of plagues, very similar to the plagues that afflicted Egypt during the time of Moses in the Old Testament.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of Contagion to a certain degree, because we're faced with this awful prospect.
Well, I mean, the whole gist of this story, the seed for the story, came from the fact that we seem to be, as humankind, afflicted with these rolling series of plagues. You know, we had the Black Death in Europe, and then we saw the Spanish flu, and then the AIDS crisis. And sort of the seed for this came from the Zika virus that spread around. You know, here's a virus that started in a Ugandan monkey, yet has spread around the globe to the point where we're seeing cases in Florida, and now just last week there was a case in Texas. And here we see a virus that's causing, you know, crippling birth defects, but we don't seem to be able to stop it. We seem to be always literally caught with our pants down when it comes to these organisms that appear out of nowhere.
I was going to ask if, in fact, some of these more recent problems that you've discussed, Zika and bird flu, that sort of thing, whether that was inspiration for the book. But clearly,
it sure was, because the book, you know, serves somewhat as a cautionary tale. It serves as a sort of a model about not only the fact that we have difficulty dealing with these organisms that appear out of nowhere, but also the fact that nature seems to, you know, push back against us oftentimes. A lot of these viruses have arisen because we've tread where maybe we shouldn't have. They believe the AIDS virus came because they were cutting a road through an African jungle. These green monkeys that were carrying the virus allowed it to break into humans, and there it spread. And likewise with Uganda virus, there's a monkey in Uganda. Again, it was just a matter of industrialization, deforestation that releases a lot of these organisms into the environment. So it's almost like nature is pushing back against our damage to the planet.
You have something of a science background yourself.
I do.
As a veterinarian.
Exactly.
That helpful in a book like this, in a plot like
this?
It
is. I mean, I think it helps with my research more than anything, and that I like to follow the biology and the science. And so when I was learning about the Zika virus, I looked at the biology, the pathogenesis, how that spreads, because I wanted to create a virus sort of similar to that. But in this case, the virus that appears in this book afflicts specifically male children, very similar to in the 10th plague of Moses, which was the death of the firstborn sons, and that became sort of the thrust for the story. So it's definitely helpful. I also like to fold animals into my stories. I can't escape my veterinary background completely. There's one side of my brain that loves animals, loves medicines, and loves science. And now that I don't practice full-time, I just do a little bit of volunteer work with my veterinary degree. Animals have been creeping more and more into my books.
What about that moment when you decided to chuck the more or less chuck the veterinary part of your life and get into this part, the novelist? You're very prolific, more than 20 books, as I
read. This is my 33rd book. Yeah, wow. This is the 12th book in the series, but 33 books total.
Wow, and you have time to sit and talk with us?
In my pocket, I'm actually writing another novel right now on my cell phone. No, it was a strange transition. I didn't think it was going to be a career. I thought it was just going to be a hobby. My clients began suspicious that something was going on, mostly because, you know, the poster in the lobby, get your cat spayed, get a free book. And they began to, you know, question me, you know, Jim, why are you – you had a successful veterinary hospital. What's this business of writing that you're doing? And for that point, I had been practicing for 15 years, and veterinary medicine was my paycheck, and writing was just a hobby, something I dabbled with. I thought it wouldn't be cool to walk into a bookstore one day and see your book on a shelf. And I thought, but, you know, down the line, it'd be sort of cool to maybe flip that around and have writing be my paycheck and veterinary medicine be a hobby. And that's pretty much what I've achieved at this point.
Well, you don't look old enough to have written 33 books because they take a little time to write. How long does it take you to write a book like this, 400 and some odd pages?
Well, I've been doing roughly 2 books a year.
Wow.
And I do about 90 days of research and 6 months to write the first draft. But I am also researching another novel while I'm finishing a draft. So it allows me to get 2 books done fairly comfortable. The last 3 years, I made the mistake of committing to doing 3 books a year. So that's 9 books in 3 years was probably more than I should have attempted to do, but I got through that.
Doesn't it get kind of crowded when you're researching one book and writing another to kind of mix up some of the things that you're talking about?
Oh, no, it's a great
about?
Deal of fun. Typically, it takes about an hour to write a page. I write 5 pages a day, so about 5 hours of new writing. But by that time, I'm ready for a break a little bit. I'm ready to do something different. So it's fun to just sort of recharge the batteries by doing a little research on the next book.
I'm always interested in the process that authors use. To many, it's a process that's very similar. They work alike. What is yours? Do you get up early and write, or do you write just in the mornings and then take the afternoons off?
It varies. I work with more on a page count deadline. I need to get those 5 pages done every day. So if I start early, I can get done early and run off to a matinee. If I'm, playing on Facebook too much or answering emails or walking the dogs or kayaking, then sometimes I'm up to midnight finishing that 5th page.
You have to be very disciplined. You have to be a self-starter, don't you?
It's very easy to do other things than get pages written. So self-discipline is an important part of being a writer. And I think every writer has to find that combination, that process that works for them. And I've talked to many different writers over the years, and we all are somewhat different in our approach. Some set hour limits. Some lock the door and post a note to their children, do not disturb. Okay. So we all have our own methods to try to get those pages done.
What about writer's block? We hear about that.
I don't have time for writer's block, is what I usually tell, because I'm committed for so many books. But, I've spoken to authors that actually have writer's block, which is a debilitating psychological issue, and I feel sorry for them that they're suffering from that. Probably the closest I've got to that state is I will oftentimes paint my characters into a corner that I have no idea how to get them out of. Mm-hmm. And I like those moments, because if I don't know how to get them out of that jam, my readers aren't going to either. So that works well for me, but then, of course, I have to figure out how to get them out of that jam, and that sometimes will stymie me for a bit.
You know, we basically hear from many writers that as they begin a book, they have a basic idea where they want to go.
Right.
They have an outline, but it's not all there, that a lot of it comes to them as they're moving along, and ideas change, and circumstances change.
Right. I'm of that same sort of ilk. I know the beginning. I know the end. I know a few tent poles that are going to support the story. But I don't necessarily know how A connects to B connects to C. To me, the joy of writing is that discovery between those tent poles. It's that twist of the plot or that character trait that pops out of nowhere that you discover that day. And that's what keeps my batteries charged. Now, some authors are different. Jeffrey Deaver is notorious for writing 200-page outlines for a story, and then he just, as he jokingly says, he just throws in dialogue and he's done.
Right. It would seem 200 pages of outline
exactly.
is almost an entire book, although yours is at least twice that long. You know, another thing, and I want to get back to this, certain points of the book and will in a moment, but one of the things that's always intrigued me about writers is how they come up with the names of their characters. You have a few characters with very unusual names. You put your finger in a phone book and say, that's an interesting one. I think I'll use that. How does that work?
Well, sometimes it's actually people I know. Uh-huh. A lot of people will pester me, put me in a book, Jim, put me in a book. And I always tell them, well, if I put you in the book, I'm going to kill you in a horrible, horrible manner. As long as you're okay with that, I will put you in a book. Uh-huh. But otherwise, I do try to tailor the names so sort of they somewhat reflect the character. The main character is Commander Grayson Pierce in the series. He goes by Gray. And here's a figure that is not necessarily black or white. He is sort of walking this ground in between. His mind works a little bit different than everybody else in that he sort of looks, he works outside the box. He sort of is good at taking disparate pieces and putting together a good jigsaw puzzle solver. And so his name sort of fits who he is as a character.
And another character named Painter, which I found to be an unusual name.
Exactly. No, Painter is
the first name.
Painter is his first name. Painter, yeah. Crow. He is he's half Native American, and so I wanted to give him a name that has a little bit of a Native American flair to it, yet be unique.
And how about romance? How about romance and dealing with that and intimacy, if I may put it that
way? Sure. I mean, I think any novel, it's hard not to have that type of relationship established. I stumbled upon an article just recently, and it was directed to me through Facebook. I said, hey, did you read this article? I went to this article, and the article is titled something along the lines of, James Rollins is a romance writer, but he just doesn't know it. And it very detailed article about, you know, breaking down exactly how many romantic tropes I use in my novels, but I think a lot of writers, when you're coming to, you know, casting these characters into these dire situations, a mixture of strong women and strong men, you know, things are going to happen.
Can a novel work, a popular novel work, without that element?
I've read novels where they don't have, but I think it. Yeah. I think it definitely adds another level of dimension to a story when there's that romantic interest.
Before we move on back to the story,
sure. There are
certain things I do want to touch upon. We should point out to our audience that you have a Missouri-St. Louis background.
I do.
University of Missouri graduate of veterinary school.
Yep. Grew up in Manchester, went to Parkway South Junior High and Parkway West Senior High.
And how long ago was all of that?
Well, I graduated from Parkway West in 1979, and I graduated out of Mizzou in 1985.
I'm going to take a quick break now, Jim, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Then we'll come back and talk more about the book. I'm talking with James Rollins. He's the author of The Seventh Plague and more than 30 other books, by the way. Seventh Plague is just out. It's his latest book. We'll come back, continue the conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And now we are back with Jim Rollins, author of The Seventh Plague. You have some interesting historical characters in your book. Nikola Tesla, Stanley and Livingston, if you don't mind, Mark Twain. Now, wait a minute. This is a modern book. How do you work these guys into the story?
Well, you know, I always wanted to have Mark Twain in a book. You know, I liked a little acknowledgement of my Missouri roots. But I didn't know where to fold him into a story until I was was interested in Nikola Tesla. Nikola Tesla is sort of the father of our modern electrical grid. He is the inventor of the alternating currents. He bumped heads with Thomas Edison in the past, who was the proponent of the direct energy current, direct current. And so he is a sort of visionary, some mystery surrounding him. But he's also pals with Mark Twain, which I found just shocking to learn.
This is historically
accurate.
This is true,
yeah. Okay. Mark Twain would hang around Tesla's lab, I'm sure being a general nuisance. One of the anecdotes that I read was that over dinner one night, Mark Twain told Tesla, you know, I'm a little backed up, a little constipated, you know, I'm just maybe I need to end this dinner early. And Tesla goes, no, come to my lab. I believe I can help you. He goes, what are you talking about? Come to my lab. And so Twain, being Twain, says, yeah, I'll go along. And so he goes to Tesla's lab, and Tesla says, well, I've invited this new oscillating device. It's what I call an earthquake machine. It vibrates at very strong speeds. Climb on. And so...
Climb on. Oh,
yep.
My
so,
Lord.
So Twain climbs on this oscillating disc. Twain turns the machine on, and within 30 seconds, Twain is running to the bathroom. Apparently, the earth did move for him. And so not only was Tesla the father of the modern electrical grid, apparently he's found the cure for constipation. So, you know, I like this sort of odd pairing of this man of words and this man of science. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to put him into a story? But I didn't know the story. But I thought, you know, if I'm going to do a story with them, it's got to be a big story. It's got to be a story of biblical proportions. So when I got this idea for this sort of modern take on Moses' 10 plagues, I'm going to fold these characters into the book.
And Stanley and Livingston?
Again, this is true. Mark Twain was friends with Stanley, and I was fascinated by that relationship. And the more I learned about that relationship between Stanley and Livingston, they were friends after Stanley rescued Livingston out of the darkest heart of Africa. And most times when you look at that story, you know, Livingston comes off somewhat in a bad light. Here's a guy that, you know, had to be rescued by Stanley. There's that famous line, you know, Dr. Livingston, I presume. Mm-hmm. And so it always seems sort of like Stanley is the damsel in distress, the one that needs saving. He's got him. He went to Africa, didn't know what he was doing, got himself into a jam, and Stanley had to rescue him. But the truth is, it's the exact opposite. So, you know, Livingston was a great advocate for stopping the slave trade in Africa. He was beloved by the tribes that he encountered, whereas Stanley was the exact opposite. He was sort of a tyrant. He ran ramshot over the tribesmen. He supported the slave trade in Africa. And so when both gentlemen died, Livingston ended up being, put into he's interred at Westminster, whereas Stanley's relatives tried to get him in Westminster, and he was denied because of this sort of strange past.
The relationship with the natives, if you will, in Africa is an integral part of the story.
It
because
is.
They present him with a gift, which then becomes really the backbone of the whole
and
thing.
It's all, and that's all true too. I mean, it's interesting that when Livingston died, he died in Africa because even though he was rescued, he stayed in Africa and continued because he wanted to really fight the slave trade. And when he passed away in a small village, he was honored. They actually buried his heart underneath the tree in that village, and then they mummified his body and sent it back to England, where it was interred.
You know, there are so many moving parts to this story. I mean, there is science. There's the biblical references, which are very important and actually part of the title. You mentioned the Ten Plagues.
Right.
I'm curious as to how you put all this together. I mean, is there a moment when you're saying, gee, I think this would work and that would work, and I'm just going to throw these together? And
It is literally a jigsaw puzzle. And
yeah.
It's one of the fun aspects of building a plot is, you know, I'm always got my antenna up for that next idea, something that might become a part of a story. I'm looking for that historical mystery, maybe a piece of history that ends in a question mark, something I can solve within the pages of a novel. And a bit of science, a whiz-bang science, you know, something that's interesting that maybe challenges us as a human species, looking at where that's headed. But then the hard part then is trying to find that piece of history and that piece of science that can go together, because I want to build a roller coaster from the past to the present. And then I'll play. You know, I just accumulate a vast amount of these little breadcrumbs, these little tidbits, and then start trying to fit them together. It's a great deal of fun.
Do you find them or do they find you?
A combination of both. You know, I've always, I subscribe to 22 different magazines, both online and print. I'm addicted to the National Geographic Channel, Discovery Channel, Science Channel. I have a notebook on my end table that I make notes when I'm watching those programs. I like to talk to people, too. Oftentimes, when I'm traveling, if I'm in a town, I'll ask somebody, you know, tell me a secret nobody knows about this place, or tell me a mystery. And oftentimes, that becomes the seed for the story. This actually came about, even in this story, as I was in Egypt, and I encountered an Egyptologist that was offered a sort of alternate timeline to Egyptian history, one that supported the fact that the story in the Book of Exodus, which most archaeologists consider to be legend or parable because they couldn't find a match in Egyptian history for those events. Well, he sort of offered a different timeline that would actually position where you can find the historical evidence to support that Moses' story was potentially based on historical events and not just mythology.
And the Nile, the blood of the Nile, the blood in the Nile.
Exactly.
Is I guess, the cause. I'm only halfway through the book.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin it.
No, and I don't want it to be ruined for me. But that is the source of this virus, if you will.
Exactly.
That causes the whole
problem. And even that's triggered a little bit by climatic changes that occurred in Egypt in the ancient past. There was a volcanic explosion that is known that cast a big pall of ash over Egypt, which changed the climate dramatically. And it's believed that that was the inciting cause for this cascade of plagues that occurred. And here we are ourselves dealing with, you know, global warming, climate change, and this sort of, again, a cautionary tale, what might happen. Like, just recently we've learned about some natives in Siberia that have been inflicted with anthrax because of the melting of the ice up there that's releasing these reindeer carcasses that were harboring this organism for a century. They've thawed out, and the anthrax is still there. It's got released, and now has killed people up there.
Wow. One of the fascinating parts that I've read has been your description of how these various plagues could be explained and how kind of one led to the other.
Exactly.
And there's a real logic to
it. It is. There's
all
a sort of a rational explanation for that series.
I mean, raining frogs, for instance.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so,
no.
But there is actually a rational, you know, a scientific basis behind that.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it to the readers to kind of.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin too
this.
Much of it.
No, absolutely not. Again, going back to something you mentioned a moment ago, you talked about being on location in Egypt. I wanted to ask you about how much travel you do for a book like this and for this book. And obviously, Egypt was one of your locales, but I'm at a point in the book now where the characters are in the Arctic, which is a much different kind of environment. Did you go there to kind of figure out and experience what that was like?
I did. I didn't go all the way up to Ellesmere Island, but I did went to the area where the Northwest Passage is sort of documented being. And again, talked to natives in those areas, tried to get stories behind that, learned a lot about the historical basis behind the HMS Erebus and the HMS Terror, the two ships that were trying to find the Northwest Passage, became frozen up there. And it's sort of a harrowing tale of cannibalism, madness, and the loss of those entire crew. And that becomes sort of a part of the story also, as you'll eventually find out.
Yeah, well, I'm at the point now where it's very, very clear, and we read this in the newspapers almost every day, about the competition among so many nations to kind of lay claim to that part of
right.
the world, or at least have access to what's there, the mineral rights and
it's
that
a huge
sort of
political
thing.
Hotbed, you know, between Canada, Russia, and Denmark. They're all trying to gain access to the territory that's opening up because of all the melting ice.
Yeah, you talked about being on location, and do you know Ridley Pearson?
He's a
friend of ours. He's on the program.
Sure, recently. He's local too.
Absolutely. And I think he spends a lot of time out in Sun Valley these days, but he spends a lot of time here as well. But in his latest book, it was about Istanbul. And during our conversation, I said, you know, what was it like spending all that time in Istanbul? And he said, well, I didn't. And I said, what? I said, it was so detailed. And he said, well, I read about it a lot, and I used Google Earth, and I used all these other devices and the Internet
sure.
that were available to me to really research it that way.
And that happened with me with my first book in the Sigma Force series, Sandstorm. The story takes place in the country of Oman, and I've never been to the country of Oman, but I contacted a gentleman that was selling Omani products online. I said, hey, you know, I'm writing a book about your country. Would you mind being my boots on the ground when it comes mm-hmm. to getting the details correct? And he said, well, you know, are you going to be derogatory about our country? Yeah. And I go, no, my books are generally travel logs of places. And so he said, well, then sure, I'll be happy to do that. Well, somehow word passed up the chain in Oman, and I got an engraved invitation from the Sultan of Oman to come to his country and tour his country before I wrote the book. So I was very excited about that. I was all prepared to go out there, but unfortunately 9/11 happened, and then I got a little response afterwards saying, maybe this isn't the best time to come out after all. So I had to write that book, which mostly is set in the country of Oman, from the seat of my pants, from just talking to that gentleman, getting the details correct. And again, I received many emails afterwards from people that have been to Oman and said, hey, you know, when were you there? Because they thought it was accurate enough.
Do you feel any obligation when you're doing something like that to send the manuscript or portions of the manuscript to people involved or who have helped you just to make sure?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
In one of my books, I had a sort of a dynamic duo of an Army Ranger and his military war dog. And so I had done a USO tour to Iraq and Kuwait in the winter of 2010 and approached these gentlemen and their dogs to find out what that relationship was like, started a friendship with them. And I used them to vet the books that I wrote based on those characters to make sure those were accurate.
Hmm. Do you get quick responses to things like this? I mean, when you send the manuscript, do they get back to you quickly?
Yeah, generally, I'll tell them I need, you know, a response by this. I'm under deadline, and I have an editor breathing down my neck. So there's, I'll tell them, can you read this by this time? And if so, great. If not, these are the sections that I'm really particularly interested in you reviewing. So if they can't read the whole book, maybe they could just review the sections that I want them to double check.
What role does the editor play? I mean, you've written more than 30 books. You're a good writer, obviously, a successful writer. Do you just send it to some young man or young woman?
Well, I've been with the acquiring editor for my very first book, Subterranean, was Alyssa Kuch. Mm-hmm. And 33 books later, I'm still with the same editor, Alyssa Kuch. And I trust her input. You know, when I turned to Subterranean, it was 640 pages long. Her first comment to me was, your book needs to be 30% longer. Mm-hmm. And she was right. And so I had to trim. And I probably fought a little bit against some of those edits. But she was, you know, ultimately I did what she asked because she was right. And so over the course of 33 novels, I've come to trust her judgment. And so oftentimes she may ask something that I disagree with, and we'll talk about why she's asking that. But it's nice having that relationship, which is rare. A lot of editors have a tendency to be a revolving door in most publishing houses. And so to have the same editor for 33 books is great.
Give me an example, if you would, of the kind of thing that she might say that you might yin and yang about.
Well, for one example is that, like in that first book, she said that in the gist of that book is there's a cavern system underneath Antarctica that this group needs to explore. And she told me that these characters need to be down that hole by page 50. Well, my original manuscript, they weren't down that hole until page 100. So I kept trimming it down. Well, look, Lisa, they're down the hole by page 75. I said 50. Okay, well, he edited some more. Okay, look, I'm down to 65. They're in the page by 65. He says, she said, I said 50. And so the last edit was so excruciating to get those, you know, trim down the last scenes that I thought were so valuable and so important. But ultimately, she was right. The pacing would have been much slower if I had stuck to my guns.
So is it more likely to be about pacing and that sort of thing than in changing descriptive passages?
Oh, it's all of the above. Really? It's, you know, this description needs to be beefed up, or you're getting a little long-winded here. In one book, I had to sort of explain to the readers quantum physics. Mm-hmm. They had to understand the basis of quantum physics. So how am I going to do that without boring the reader to death? In my first draft, that was 11 pages long, that description, she was going, there's no way they're going to tolerate this. You need to get this, you know, it's down to 3 pages. I thought, how am I going to describe the nutshell of quantum physics in 3 pages? So I decided to use pictures. So I incorporated some pictures, because, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words, right?
And you have them in this book, I should point
exactly.
out.
Exactly. I think it's helpful sometimes to get some type of visual with it, especially there's some maps in this that are critical to the story that are important to see, I think, on the page. And it's character, it's plot, it's description, it's dialogue. She covers everything.
You would really have to be able to get along well with an editor then, as you've described it here, because I've often heard authors talk about the book as their baby, you know, and it's very, very hard. For instance, when they sell to a movie, sell rights to a film, they lose their baby because they
of
don't
course.
Have control of it anymore. I would think it would be very, very difficult working with an editor when there's something you really feel strongly about and they feel strongly about. You'd have to get along in order not to just break the relationship.
It does, but I always, if I get to that type of a logjam with Lissa, there's a reason she's asking something of me. Mm-hmm. And then the way I usually get around that is, you know, what made you think this way about this part of the story? And she will then explain. Then I'll realize, oh, okay, now I see where the issue is. And then oftentimes it's not that specific page that's the issue. It's something that I've done earlier that's created that's that problem. And if I can untie, if I can get that logjam out of the way, the book then will flow. And this issue we have with between each other will be resolved.
And it's in, obviously, your self-interest to take the best route that's possibly available. Our time is winding down. One other thing about the book that I wanted to ask you about and explain and entice people to want to read the book. What are electricity eaters?
This is true. I mean, this will sound outlandish when I say it out loud, but just recently scientists have discovered bacteria that survive by consuming electricity. They discovered this by basically just planting electrodes in mud, shocking the mud, and these little guys came up to feed. No one suspected they existed. These are bacteria that basically scavenge electrons off of surfaces that have electrical currents. And again, I love the fact that nature surprises us. You know, again, scientists are still struggling what to do with these organisms. There's labs that are looking to build these living biocables that will transmit electricity. Other labs are looking to see if these could be little batteries for nanomachines that might have industrial uses. Of course, me being a thriller writer, I'm thinking, well, what if one of these was infectious? What might a disease like that look like?
Yeah. And there we go. There we go. The seventh plague, right?
Exactly.
You working on anything now? Well, I'm sure you are.
Of course.
What can you tell us about what the
Well, the next book will be dealing with Pearl Harbor and a connection that goes all the way back to the Civil War and deals with some science that is quite gruesome, which I don't want to elaborate at this point yet.
Sounds like another sweeping plot for Jim Rollins, the best-selling author with a Parkway school system and Mizzou background, talking about his latest novel, The Seventh Plague. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.